Our speaker today has demonstrated throughout his lifetime that he is a man of vision, courage, and dedication. These attributes are clearly evidenced in the size and quality of this university from which you graduate today. Dr. Hanna's impact upon education in the United States is reflected in the fact that no fewer than 30 people whose lives he touched became presidents of colleges and universities throughout the nation. Less evident, but nonetheless of great significance to mankind, are the millions of people throughout the world who have benefited from his deep conviction that human beings, without any reference to race, color, creed, or geography, should have the opportunity to live happy and useful lives. It is my privilege and honor to present as your commencement speaker the man who was affectionately known to my colleagues and the students of an earlier era as Uncle John. He will speak to the topic in 1999. President John A. Hanna, Emeritus.
Mr. President, members of the Board of Trustees, members of the faculty, members of the graduating class of 1979, and your guests, ladies and gentlemen, I want on this occasion, on behalf of all of the friends of Michigan State University, to express for all of them our sincere gratitude to President Hardin for all that he has done to strengthen this university during the past 18 months and for what he will continue to do in the last 2 months of his presidency. He deserves our rigorous applause and a sincere thank you from all of us. I suspect that I have participated in more university commencements than anyone else in this audience, and I shall be brief and concise. And first, I will introduce myself so that you may know how I acquired my convictions and my biases. I graduated from MAC, as this university was then known, in the spring of 1923, 56 years ago, and went to work the next day as a member of the Cooperative Extension Service. 46 years later, in the spring of 1969, I left the president's office at Michigan State University and embarked for 5 years on a new career as administrator of the United States Agency for International Development. And in that role, I studied and dealt with many of the problems of the world. We were particularly concerned with the role of the United States in encouraging the development of the poorest countries in the third world, where two-thirds of all the world's people live, scattered over all the continents, Asia, Africa, Latin America, and the independent islands over the world's oceans. In 1974, at the request of the United Nations, I embarked on a third career, first as Deputy Secretary General of the World Food Conference held in Rome in November of that year, and then for almost 4 more years as Executive Director of the United Nations World Food Council. In that role, we dealt with one of the world's most important and most pervasive problems, How is the world to feed its hungry and starving people with first emphasis on the poorest in the food deficit countries? It's pleasant to now be back in MSU country and to be again a peripheral part of this great university. When I left MSU, I swore off making speeches, and particularly commencement speeches. But after much salesmanship and persuasive persistence on the part of President Hardin, I stand before you, called upon to speak to the graduating class of 1979 and your families and friends. And I am happy to participate again in an MSU commencement and to be able to join with all of you on this occasion. William Rainey Harper, president of the University of Chicago at the turn of the century, was one of the most distinguished university presidents of his era. With funds made available by the first John Rockefeller, they built the University of Chicago lock, stock, and barrel, and staffed it with many of the best minds in America. One of the famous commencement addresses in American higher education was delivered 76 years ago by Dr. Harper to the University of Chicago graduating class of 1903. It took him less than 1 minute to deliver it. And I'll read it to you. And he said, "Seniors, you came here 4 years ago to be educated. An educated person is one who, by the time he is 20, has a clear theory formed by the light of human experience of what constitutes a significant life. By the age of 30, he has developed an awareness of the world and a philosophy of dealing with it. If a person reaches those stages in life without having such a theory and without such an awareness, no matter how many facts he has learned or how many processes he has mastered, he is foolish, unhappy, and probably dangerous." The end of the quote and the end of the speech. Now, I'm tempted to follow President Harper's example. What he said in 1903 holds true today, but the passage of 76 years has added a good many complications to his simple message. The diploma you receive today is a ticket admitting you into a much more complex world than his. It's a puzzling world and a stimulating one that presents far more traps and far more opportunities than the world of that day. During the last 10 years, I had no significant contact with any university. I saw few college students, and I knew little of what was going on in higher education in the United States. Instead, I saw much of all the world beyond this campus, and particularly that part of the world that is troubled and poor and hungry. And coming back in September 1979, I find many things greatly changed at MSU, as they have changed in colleges and universities everywhere. The last 10 years has brought a bewildering variety of new concepts into education. Computer-assisted instruction, management information services, inquiry-directed learning, new fields of instruction and research. And I expected this. Things move quickly everywhere these days. But it was not the changes on the campus or the changes in the kind of education MSU now provides that struck me most. It was the change in my concept of education after 10 years of seeing what the rest of the world is like in those parts of the world where violence and abject poverty are the normal ways of life. Much of the kind of education which this university made available to the class of 1969, 10 years ago, when I left, would be obsolescent or obsolete today, just as 1979 will be 20 years from now in 1999. And I want to focus with you this afternoon for a few minutes on your lives in 1999 and beyond. It isn't that far away. In 1999, 20 years from now, you will be on the edge of a new century, the 21st century since the birth of Christ. You will be at about the midpoint of your own lives. Most of you will be settled into the profession or vocation at which you'll earn your living for the rest of your life. You will have families and mortgages. And many of you will be in positions of leadership in your businesses and communities, possibly in this state or elsewhere in America or in Washington or overseas. And in June 1999, some of you may well be sitting here watching your sons and daughters graduate from MSU. During your years here, you should have learned much to help you, to help prepare you for all of this. But how much of what you have learned will be true or useful or relevant in 1999? In our time, more than in any other in history, events are changing traditional modes of human endeavor at a faster rate and more completely than ever before. If you are going to be sensitive to the emerging needs of society that change always brings, you will have to have developed a personal plan, a personal approach to life, as President Harper said, for keeping your balance on this spinning globe, and to cope in 1999, you will also have had to develop that sense of awareness, the feeling of engagement with the rest of the world that President Harper spoke of in 1903. Some of the older among you here today may remember the name of Wendell Willkie. He was an Indiana lawyer who ran for the presidency against Franklin Roosevelt in 1940, and like many unsuccessful candidates, he has been more or less forgotten. But Willkie was an extraordinary person, and after he lost to Roosevelt, he did an extraordinary thing. He accepted a mission from the man who had defeated him. His task was to travel around the world as the president's personal representative and to report to the president and to the nation on what he saw. And he did so. And he returned to write a best-selling book. And it was called One World. And what he said then is worth recalling today. He wrote, "To survive, we must create a single world in which all people have the opportunity for a good life, a safe life, and a meaningful life, a world in which people matter. It should be a place," he said, and this is a direct quote, "in which a man can stand up straight," unquote. The world has made some progress toward this ideal since then. We've learned a lot about how to accomplish it, but we still have much to learn and a long way to go. And this sounds like an old and often repeated theme in commencement addresses, to the effect that commencement should be regarded as the beginning of learning and not the end, and you may be already turning off your attention. But this is really not what I want to say. What I am concerned with is the ability of this class of 1979 to survive until 1999 and to cope with what our society will be like then. And I don't mean simply professional survival. Certainly everyone needs to keep up with the training needed for his job. Most professional education is about 30% obsolete within 10 years after graduation. And 60% of it is obsolete after 20 years. But I'm talking about a different kind of survival, of the need to be constantly a part of the world in which you live, of the environment that surrounds you, of the arts and sciences that we have inherited and that we create, but most of all, of the need for belonging with others, of knowing who they are and what they are and how they interact with each other. And let me be specific by mentioning only four areas. And the first is language. You speak, and I hope you write, acceptable American English. All of you. Some of you may know a little French or Spanish or some other language. But in 1999, you need to know, and your church and your children certainly will, Spanish, Russian, or Chinese, or Arabic, possibly one or two other languages, to move effectively in the world. My experience with USAID and the UN World Food Council have convinced me of this. We Americans will never be able to get along with the world's people unless we can talk to them and listen to them with understanding. And that means in their own languages. Second, geopolitics. The young men and women who graduated here before you had to learn the hard way where Iwo Jima and Busan and Da Nang are. And we are now learning, when we stop at a gas pump, more about Riyadh and Kuwait and Qatar. And your generation may need to become more concerned and more knowledgeable, not only about Delhi and Brasilia and Cairo, but also about less known places like Lagos and Khartoum and La Paz and Johannesburg and other places all over the world that most of you would have trouble locating today without the help of an atlas. And before you do, you'd better learn where they are and who lives there and what they, too, would like to expect from life. Third, economics. You probably understand better than Adam Smith how economic systems work. But what will be the economics of capitalism or socialism or Islam in 1999? How will we deal with those who produce and sell and buy in ways different from ours? And four, and the last one I'm going to mention, is ecology. In 1969, when I left the president's office of Michigan State, people had hardly heard that word. We know a lot more about it now. But what we know now is likely to be useless in 1999. As public and government and science come more and more to grapple with environmental problems, it will cost your generation a lot of money to understand and solve the problems of environment. And it may cost you your life if you don't. Now, I may have made this sound more difficult than it really is. Every graduating class for the past 200 years has faced the difficult problems of that day. Knowledge doubled between the years of 1850 and 1900. It doubled again between 1900 and 1950, and doubled again between 1950 and 1970. And will certainly double again before the year 1999. But the point is that the capacity of the human mind to cope with expanding knowledge is equal to the capacity of mind to create it. We have the means to meet the challenges of the rest of the century and the century after it if we keep learning how to use them. And it would be easy to look around the world today and despair, as many do. Nothing seems to be in place, and we seem to live in a series of crises. But I do not believe things are that bad. They are better than they were. We have made progress. There is reason to hope. It is an encouraging time to be young, for there is so much to do that can be done. Now, I want to tell you a little true story. I remember seeing a play here at MSU in 1942, the beginning of the war, called The Skin of Our Teeth by Thornton Wilder. Then we were in the early days of the Great War. Just behind us was a long depression, the rise of Hitler and Mussolini, the tragedy of Pearl Harbor. And Wilder's play spoke to a generation pushed almost to the breaking point. It concerned a family called the Antrobus family, a father, mother, son, and daughter, and the family maid. And this family had had nothing but troubles since their landlords evicted them from the Garden of Eden 2 million years before. They had survived fire and flood and earthquake and glaciers, and here they were again engaged in their 10,000th war, and it seemed just too much. And Mr. Antrobus was about ready to give up, and he says, and this is a quote, "That's all we do, always beginning again. How do we know it'll be better than last time? Why do we go on pretending? Someday the whole earth is going to turn cold and dead anyway." End of the quote. But then he looks around and takes heart. It's been 2 million years of trouble, but there have been victories and there have been happy times. And so he takes heart and goes on with these words, another quote, "All I ask is the chance to build new worlds. God has always given us that chance. We've come a long way. We've learned. We're learning. We'll live." End of the quote. And the curtain falls. And the audience thinks that's the end of the play. But the family maid steps out in front of the curtain and says to the audience, and quote, this is the quote, "You go home. The end of the play isn't written yet. We may have to go on for ages and ages, but the end of this play isn't written yet." And the audience goes home, and we do go on. And like Mr. Antrobus and his family, who survived by the skin of their teeth, we will survive. The end of our play isn't written yet. And if my remarks this afternoon have a message, it is this. Having lived a fairly long life, I am convinced that only people are really important, and I'll say it again, only people are really important. And that is true in Michigan, and the United States, and everywhere else in the world. Political systems evolve and change, and social systems evolve and change, and economic systems evolve and change. But one of the most pervasive of all human desires, for people of all races, all skin colors, all religions and economic philosophies everywhere, is an instinctive aspiration for every human being to crave recognition as a dignified human being, and beyond that, a hope for the maximum possible freedom for each person to determine the course and pattern of his own life, so that his own or her life may be meaningful and satisfying for him, and hopefully better for his children than it may have been for the parents. And someday, I suppose, the human play will have an ending. But each decade and each century and each generation has something to say about it, how it will end, and how the drama unfolds. And you in this class of 1979, for you, your responsibility is to help to write the next act. And for you, that unwritten act is the most important one in all of human history. I believe with conviction that this is a great time to be young, embarking on a new life career. Yours is a great opportunity, and the key question is, what will you do with it? And I wish for each of you good luck, happiness, and Godspeed always.
Thank you, President Hanna. This group has expressed far better than anything I could say the appreciation and the respect in which we hold you. You have truly made this a memorable occasion in the history of Michigan State University. By authority of the State of Michigan, vested in the Board of Trustees and delegated to me, I shall now confer degrees upon the candidates recommended by the faculty. I call first, however, upon Dr. Herbert J. Oyer, Chairman of the Faculty Committee on Honorary Degrees, to present the candidates for honorary degrees.
President Hardin, on behalf of the committee, Faculty Committee on Honorary Degrees, I'm very pleased this afternoon to present to you two individuals who have been nominated for honorary doctorates. It is a particular pleasure and high honor, Mr. President, to present to you at this time John A. Hanna for the degree of Doctor of Humanities.
You want to go right around there, Mr. John A. Hanna, although the talents of hundreds of men and women have contributed richly to the building of Michigan State University, those men and women had the particular good fortune to be led by an administrator of unmatched brilliance during the university's years of rapid growth. You, John A. Hanna, were our admired and respected leader during a presidency of 28 years. And this vast campus and its varied programs, with their international outreach and intellectual prestige, remind us in outline and detail of your vision, your courage, and your humanity. A member of the class of 1923, you assumed the presidency in 1941 and earned wide recognition that included the chairmanship of the American Council on Education and the presidency of the National Association of State Universities and Land-Grant Colleges. You have held presidential appointments under Presidents Roosevelt, Truman, Eisenhower, Johnson, and Nixon. For your work as Assistant Secretary of Defense for Manpower and Personnel, you were awarded the Medal of Freedom in 1954. From 1957 until 1969, you served as Chairman of the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights. Retirement as President of Michigan State University has brought no diminution in your responsibilities. You served as the administrator of the U.S. Agency for International Development from 1969 until 1974. In 1974, you were named Deputy Secretary General of the World Food Conference. And in 1975, you were appointed by the Secretary General of the United Nations as Executive Director of the United Nations World Food Council, the body charged with implementing the recommendations of the World Food Conference. You have, moreover, played a key role in organizing and launching the International Fund for Agricultural Development. Yet, despite your worldwide achievements, you have come home to East Lansing to lead our development fund and to share your wisdom with the community that still remembers you as the university presidents whose office door was always open. In recognition of your contributions to education, to international understanding, and to human development, Michigan State University is pleased to grant you the degree of Doctor of Humanities.